Good evening, everyone. Hi. We're a little bit past time. There's a lot of traffic on the road, so I wouldn't be surprised if multiple people wander in here, but it's good to see everyone tonight. Okay, I'm not my dad. But we're still doing Daniel, but I am a holiday, so we've got that part nailed down. We're in Daniel, the third chapter. I missed last week, and so he filled in for me on Romans, and he's out this week, so we'll cover for him. We've talked so far about Daniel, and that's been the first two chapters are really sort of the introduction to him, and it mentions his friends, who I will do quick quiz before you guys open. Mother, you're not allowed to answer this. What are the three names of Daniel's friends? Okay, I heard the wrong names. Their names are Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Those are their names, because those are good Hebrew names that reflect a God-fearing nation, as far as the naming scheme. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are Babylonian names that we are more familiar with because that's what is referred to more often as far as the story goes, because that's what the king calls them. But those are basically names imposed upon them in order to sort of force people to remember that they were now under Babylonian rule and they were in subjection to the Babylonian gods. We remember Daniel because we've got the book of Daniel, but what was Daniel's imposed name? Belteshazzar, right? Okay, so Belshazzar is the son of Nebuchadnezzar, his father being Nabonidus. And then, Belteshazzar is the name that was given to Daniel, but we hardly ever remember that because, well, we've got a book named after him. So anyway, we are talking about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah tonight. Before we get started, Greg, can I ask you a little prayer?
Father, we approach your throne and thankful that you have preserved your word for us so that know, Father, how to come to you and how, Father, to receive salvation. We're thankful for the book that we have, Daniel, and for the life that he led, and for the stand that he took. We're thankful, Father, for all those who have stood fast and who have refused to deny you. And Father, we're inspired by that.
Amen. Okay. Chapter 3 and verse 1 says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. So, two things on this. One, he made an image of gold. I find this interesting, following the second chapter, because of his vision, and this is not something that we always necessarily connect, but he had this vision, right, and of a big statue, and it was made up of essentially four or five parts, depending on how you want to talk about the iron, if the iron mixed with clay is a separate section or whatnot. But anyway, we've got that image, and Daniel's interpretation, right, says, you, O king, are the head of gold. So maybe Nebuchadnezzar got it in his head and went, oh yeah, I am the head of gold. I should make a statue, because I had this dream, and it, obviously it was an important dream because it troubled him, and he went through all this trouble to get the interpretation, and so now he's feeling pretty good, and he says, making this image. And then we're going to invite a list of people. So we went over satraps and prefects and governors. What does this list include? Everybody's who's anybody, really. That's what it comes down to, is anybody of influence within the region, anybody who was in power, is supposed to come to this dedication. Now, that being said, what does that say about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? They were also influential in their own right. So it wasn't just Daniel. So Daniel was set above pretty much anybody else in the kingdom, and we know that, and it's focused on quite a bit. But his friends were also fairly influential in their own right, because they were parts of these, I don't know if it, you know, there were a satrap or a prefect or a governor, it doesn't say specifically, but it does include them in this list, because they're the ones being asked at this dedication to bow down before this image. So they're part of the influential community. So they're important people in their own right. Okay, so they're supposed to come to the dedication of the image. So far, nothing bad. I mean, people set up monuments all the time. There's usually nothing wrong with that. Intrinsically, we have actually quite a lot of monuments in Washington, D.C., and it's actually quite nice to go see, and it can remind us of some of the things and the sacrifices that people have made and things. And in fact, we partake of a monument every Sunday. Those kinds of things, it's a memorial service. So those kinds of things can be good and right, and dedication services, okay, nothing wrong here. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces, so anybody who's anybody, were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O people, nations and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." Okay, now we've got the issue here, right? Because now we've set up this thing not just as a memorial of, hey, he's a great king, or hey, the empire's doing well, but now we've got this thing that we're supposed to worship, that it's supposed to be set up as an object of worship. Now, the Jews are going to have a problem with that, obviously. What I think is interesting here is it talks about, you know, the sound of each different instrument. I'm guessing that that was probably like the national anthem of the time, is that something was going to be playing, and it was either going to be, you know, maybe Nebuchadnezzar's personal theme or the national theme of Babylon if they had one. But, you know, there's going to be a band playing, and they're going to play this music, and at the sound of that, you know, it just takes me back to thinking of, like, you know, when we play the Star-Spangled Banner, like, what do we do? We all stand up, we face the flag, we, you know, pledge our allegiance to the flag in some cases, or we sing. You know, there's various things that go on as far as flag ceremonies, right? So this is a very nationalistic kind of event. This is a thing that's supposed to bring people together as opposed to alienate people. And we're seeing that it's actually going to alienate the Jews here. But notice that it says, O people, nations, and men of every language. I think it's very easy to think of the Jews as the only people who were sort of beaten down by the Babylonians. But that's not really accurate. They went and conquered a lot of people. They had an empire, right? And you don't get an empire by conquering one neighboring nation. That's just called annexation, right? That's not empire building. Empire building is where you go take over everybody that you can reach in range, and you make them all yours. And it doesn't matter what language they speak, because they're going to speak your language. And it doesn't matter what language, what nation they're from, because they're now part of your nation. And that's what this was. This was supposed to be sort of a banner-raising kind of thing of, we're all Babylonians now. We're all going to be part of this great nation together. And to do so, let's set up this guy, because, you know, he's our king. He's obviously this great leader. The gods have favored him. So we're gonna bow down and worship before there. It sounds like a decent idea if you think of it from a perfectly human standpoint, right? If you just cut morality out of it, great, you know? We've got this thing that'll build up the nation. Well, the problem is that you've cut God out of it at that point. You haven't realized that the whole point of Babylon becoming a nation was because God let them. Because God had a purpose to punish the sons of Israel and needed somebody to go do that. And so he allowed Nebuchadnezzar to come to power and to go conquer other nations in between so that he could get to the nation of Israel. I mean, it's hard to think about sometimes because we don't necessarily think of God taking such a direct hand, but when it talks about God bringing out the Babylonians to beat up or to punish the, they did beat them up, but to punish the nation of Israel, that was by design. You know, that was actually God's hand choosing this nation to go punish another nation. And so with all that, even these people who were chosen by God to go carry out a special command for him, I didn't mean that they were doing what was right. I didn't mean that they were thinking in terms of what God had in mind for them. So they were going to do this thing. Any questions and comments before we sort of dive into the part that actually deals with the three guys here? Okay, we're going to have a quiet night again tonight, I see. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of all the instruments, people fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Okay? So there's a punishment levied. So there's maybe some more resistance than we might otherwise think of people just going, yeah, but I don't really want to be a Babylonian. I kind of like being a Syrian or whatever else, or an Assyrian at the time, but maybe I don't really want to be a Babylonian. But you know what? I kind of like not being burned. So I'm just going to go along with it, and you know what? We'll be good Babylonians. And so they did. They went and did the thing. Now, what does that kind of say about how the Babylonians treated their empire building?
They wanted them to comply with theirs as opposed to letting them keep their religion and just taking up taxes and being served.
Okay. They had a fairly forceful approach to things. If you look at the different world empires and how they treated being an empire, there were some different philosophies, right? Babylonians said, we're going to take you over. We're going to make you Babylonian. We're going to force you to be Babylonian because as soon as you finally break and become a Babylonian, you're going to love being a Babylonian. It'll be great. You'll pay taxes. You'll be a good citizen. We'll just have this nice, happy empire. And that was the idea. The Assyrians before them had a different idea. The Assyrians just wanted to kill everybody. They said, you know what? If you're not an Assyrian, you're obviously the enemy. And since we can't expect that you're going to not try to kill us, we'll just kill you first. And so they did. They went around and impaled people and said, okay, we're just going to take over all this stuff. And then when they finally did conquer a nation, instead of trying to incorporate them, they would just pick people up over here and said, well, we beat your gods over here, but we don't want to necessarily let your god come back to you. So we're going to move you over here where your god can't find you. We're going to take these people over here and put them in your land because then their god won't be able to find them and then nobody will fight back against us and we'll be a good empire. Well, that didn't work very well for them either. Now you see, after the Babylonians, you've got this kind of thing here. So we've got the just kill everybody, we've got the we'll make everybody Babylonian. Well, we know in the end that didn't end up working, right? So then the Persians come in and they said, okay, how about we just encourage everybody to still worship their gods and still maintain their religion, and you can just be Persian on the side, and as long as you pay your taxes, you know, we'll help you serve your gods. We'll be benevolent overlords. And that actually lasted for a little bit longer. It worked out for all right. And then eventually the Greeks came along and had their own ideas, but that's sort of past this story. The idea here is we're in the middle here, where the Babylonians are firmly in control, and they want to make everybody Babylonian, which includes their religion. Okay, at the time, they didn't have the separation of church and state thing. The Babylonians, their religion was part of their identity, right? So if you were going to be a Babylonian, you were going to worship their gods. And if you didn't, we'll throw you in the furnace. Okay. That doesn't work for three people. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, psaltery, trigon, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Okay. So we have the informants. Doesn't name who they were, but obviously they've got a bone to pick with these Jews, and they say, hey, these guys didn't do it. Now, what's interesting to me about that is that speaks to some internal politics that are going on, because obviously Ananias, Mishael, and Azariah had some influence. That's why they were at this dedication ceremony. And obviously, in gaining that influence, they had apparently made some enemies along the way. They'd pushed some people down by their successes. If you remember when it talks about in Daniel 1 that at the end of their period of learning and when they were tested, they far exceeded everybody else. It's not comfortable to be at the top of the class. People don't like you. People don't like you when you do better than them. And so they made some enemies. And so, sure enough, when this comes about, whoever it was, whoever, you know, was the saltiest at the time went, aha! I can get these guys and knock them down a peg. And maybe, just maybe, get them out of the way completely. So they come to the king, and what do they say? First thing. What's the first thing out of their mouth? Oh, yeah. Oh, king, live forever. You're the greatest king. You know what? We just love being Babylonian. That's really what they're saying here. We are so happy that you are our king, and we're just really grateful for that. Is that what they're actually intending here? Do these sound like happy subjects in the rest of their statements? Not so much. But they know. They know that if they just come up and we don't like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they did this and this and this, and the king's going to just go, well, yeah, whatever. But if they come up and they say, oh, king, this was a great idea that you had, you know, and we're really glad that we're going to come together as a nation, and we're going to prop you up, and you're going to be our king, and everybody's going to do this thing, and we all did, and it was great. And by the way, there's these three other people, and they didn't do it, and shame on them for not being good Babylonians. Now the king goes, well, maybe I should pay attention to that. See, there's a difference in how you politic these things. And so these informants, these people who are jealous, come up with this way of getting them in trouble. You see this again later on in Daniel. I won't be teaching the class probably by that point, but people are going to do the same thing to Daniel. And yet, Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gives orders to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego that these men were brought before the king. All right. You're the king. Put yourself in the king's place. Difficult to do because none of us are kings. Probably. You are, at this point, the master of the world. You've conquested all these nations. Everybody is under your thumb. And these little guys think that they can defy my orders, right? So whatever it is that the informants have said have stoked the ego of Nebuchadnezzar enough. They've let him think with his pride. And now that's got to be assuaged, right? Because pride is talking here and he says, bring them here. But he's going to be fair about it. He's going to say, you know, I'm not going to just listen to hearsay. Even here, we see Nebuchadnezzar being a very interesting king, and probably why he lasted so long is that even when he's mad, he's got a fairly good head on his shoulders. He's not willing to just take people at their word. So he says, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? So he sounds pretty reasonable. He says, you know what? I'm willing to give you guys a break. Obviously, you've done very well for me. I'm pretty angry right now that this is even coming up. But we're going to give you a fair chance. In fact, we're going to go through the whole ceremony all over again just for you. Have you thought about that? This was probably kind of a production. you got to get the band together, they got to be all on time, they got to actually go through their stuff, and whatever other, I mean, obviously there's the music that's specifically called out here, but it can't have been just that. There was probably some sort of pomp and circumstance, just, you know what, you guys get to sit front row this time, we're going to watch and make sure you do it. But we'll do it all over again, just because you're my faithful subjects. We're going to do that.
All right, he could have just said, I heard you didn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and just throw them right in the fire. Just go ahead. Right. But no, he's willing to give them a second chance. And more than that, he's willing to personally witness. Not simply just say, oh yeah, you guys go test him again and then come back to me with the results. He's going to personally witness this. He says, you know what? If you do this very well, everything's fine. But if you don't, into the fire. Right? So reiterates the punishment. Doesn't make it any worse. Right? Well, can't really get too much worse other than, well, I'm going to kill you, and then I'm going to kill you. But the point here is he's not changing anything. It's not, you know, you're going to be thrown into the dungeons for 20 years and tortured until we finally throw you into the fire. He's just straight up, you already heard the punishment. Go ahead. We'll give you another chance. And if you're not, we'll go ahead and carry out the punishment. So even in his rage, and it says he's angry. He's in a rage. He's still thinking at least fairly clearly and says, let's go through and be a fair king on this. So, now, taking yourself out of king's shoes, and go to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. That's a pretty good deal. You've got another opportunity before the king. Now, before, some people may have thought, you know, I can serve God and not do this thing, and there's enough people around, because there's probably a lot of people around, that nobody's going to notice, and it'd be fine. Now, I'm not saying that's what went through their heads, but it could happen, right? Somebody could say, I'm okay. I'm in the crowd. I can serve God by not doing this thing, and my conscience will be clear, and no consequences will come of this. Now they're called on it. Second test of faith. So obviously they passed the first test of faith in a relatively easy environment. Obviously the threat is there, but it's still easy because they're not directly observed. Now, direct observation by the king. The king himself is threatening you. And as the king says, what God is going to be able to save you from my wrath? Second test of faith here. And this one is a lot harder because you can't fake it at this point. You're either there or you're not. And so what they say shows to what the core of their identity really is. Because at that point, you are stripped bare. I would dare say that none of us, likely, have ever been in a situation like this where your identity is called into question at such a core level, because it's either do or die, literally. And what are their words? They say, O Nebuchadnezzar, we don't even need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. They're answering two different questions in some very interesting ways. The first thing, the very first thing that they address is actually Nebuchadnezzar's last statement. It has nothing to do with the orders and nothing to do with the punishment. Their first answer, the first words out of their mouth, addresses the blasphemy that Nebuchadnezzar speaks before them. Think about that. Because Nebuchadnezzar says, what God will be able to save you from my hand? And their answer is, our God. Our God can save us. And even if he chooses not to, then they answer the second question, right? The first question is just to answer the blasphemy. And they say, our God is able to do that. And then they say, and by the way, even having said that, we are willing to follow him whether he saves us or not. Do your worst.
Even if God didn't deliver them, they were still going to serve their God. You know, Christ prayed a similar kind of prayer. And
God's going to answer our prayer, but even if it doesn't, if we're rocked by it, we should never let our faith be, you know, strained from it.
Yeah, and you see the same kind of attitude like you do with Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he says, "Let this cup pass from me, yet not if my will, your will be done." And there's two different answers there, right? Because in the garden, Jesus received the answer essentially of no. He had to go through that. But here, their faith is rewarded, as we'll find out. And the answer that they did want comes through. But regardless, the faith is the same. The trust in God is the same either way, because they said, "Look, we know this is in your hands. Do with it what you will." And that's difficult for us, because we like to be in control. We like to have a say over things. One of the things that I find the most interesting is to talk to people about flying. Okay? How many flights, American flights, crash every year? Not many. I don't know the exact number, but I looked it up at one point, and it's like a couple, maybe a dozen, that actually have some sort of major failure. And of those, very few are actually fatal. There may be one fatal plane crash of a commercial nature. I'm not talking about an individual flying their plane. But there are extremely few deaths flying in the United States every year. Last year alone, there was over 4,000 deaths on Texas highways alone. 4,000. And just one state, driving. Now, when you go to talk to people and say, "Hey, we need to go to this place," I have several coworkers who refuse to fly. They don't think it's safe. They will drive. They will drive to the location. They'll take days to get there, but they won't fly. How logical is that? If you look at the statistics, it's terrible. You are much safer in the air than you are on the ground. However, the illusion of control is there. Because when you're driving, you're driving. When you're flying, unless you're the pilot, you're doing nothing that affects your flight one way or the other. Right? And that amount of control over your life is what we want as individuals. We have a really hard time putting things out of our own hands. It's the same thing with faith on a spiritual level. We have a very hard time putting things out of our own control. That's why salvation is so hard, because it's not under your control. Now, there are things that you have been asked to do. There are things that you have within you to accept or deny Christ. You have it within you to choose to be baptized or not. But other than that, your actual salvation is up to God to give you. People don't like that. And so here, when we see those people, that's a very rare attitude for people to just simply say, "Out of our hands. It's in God's hands." We think, we trust that God's able to save us. But if he chooses not to, oh well. We're still not going to do what you want. So that's the thing, I think, the core of this whole story is to get that little verse in mind. Is first, they were going to answer the blasphemy, and they were going to get it right before whatever consequences came about, because it's entirely possible that that second sentence that they breathe is the last they'll ever get a chance to make. And so before they utter that sentence, they want to make sure that the first thing that's on their minds is said, that they're going to make sure that their God is treated as holy. And then they'll deal with the other accusation. Then they'll get through what might be their last statement ever. And so they do. They say this: "We're not going to do this." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up. Their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried them up. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Okay. Back in king's shoes. He's been really reasonable. He's given them every chance. He said, we'll redo the whole ceremony. And they have the gall to not just refuse him, but to say, don't even bother. That really nice thing you were going to do by giving us another chance, don't even try it. We're not going to do it. Rage. Rage happens here. And a little bit of foolishness. Okay? Think about it from the standpoint of a non-God-believing king. You've got a furnace. It's on fire. If you throw people into said fire, generally speaking, they're not going to last. That's just, okay, they're dead. Did he have to make it seven times hot? Is that going to kill them any harder? They're still going to be dead. But no, he's going to make an example of this. This is the point where Nebuchadnezzar says, no, my will is law. I will be treated as holy, effectively. He's going to say, these guys, we're going to make an example. We're going to make sure that the people at the end of this assembly can see the flames. So he heats it up seven times. It's hot. And it's so urgent. They got to do it so fast that this thing is basically an inferno. And the people that carry Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah just die. I get the impression that they basically get them to the doorway and the three men just effectively fall in because the other guys are on fire and perish. But the interesting thing is, not only are they haven't been stripped naked, they're wearing all their clothes, they're tied up, probably with rope, which is also flammable, they fall in still tied up. Not even the ropes have lit on fire, but it's flat out killed the warriors that are carrying them up there. There's already a difference. Nothing has happened yet from the standpoint of the rest of the story that everybody remembers, as far as being able to see in and all the wonders that we're going to talk about in a minute. But we've already got miraculous events going on. We've already got everybody else dies, and these guys just sort of like face plant into the thing, I guess. I don't know exactly how they fall into this furnace, but they're fine. You know, other than maybe being a little uncomfortable being tied up, they got nothing. They're just, all right, well, I guess we're going into the fire. Let's see if God has in mind for us to let us stay or if we're going to go. So in they go. And the cool thing here is that the story stays with Nebuchadnezzar. It doesn't go to them and talk about their emotions in it. It says, then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. What? He's watching this. Obviously, he's at a safe distance because the king, you know, his safety is paramount. But he's watching this go on. He's watching this furnace get into an inferno. He's watching these people tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the fire and die. And yet, he stands up and says, was it not three men that we bound into the midst of the fire? They replied to the king, certainly, O king. Everybody's like, do you have any more stupid questions? I mean, we all watched this happen. And he said, look, I see four men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Okay. Miraculous event number two. Not only are these three men untouched, there's another person in there, another being in there. And first of all, they're up and walking around. And second of all, their bonds have been loosed. They're not tied up anymore. They're just walking around in a fire that just by being near it killed valiant warriors. These are like frontline fighters that are probably veterans of many battles. And yet, okay, they're dead. These guys were bound and tossed in, and now they're just walking around without bonds on. That's crazy talk. From somebody who doesn't believe in God, that's just crazy. So then Nebuchadnezzar came near the door of the furnace of blazing fire and responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, and the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regards to these men that the fire had had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. So, being untouched by fire is a funny thing. How many of you have ever been around a smoker? Probably all of us, right? How close do you have to be to smell like smoke when you walk into the next room? Not real close, right? You're going to smell like fire or tobacco or whatever it is. How many of you have been next to a grill? Okay. You're going to smell like fire has a way of getting soot on you over a fairly large distance. This furnace burning 7 times hotter than it normally would, probably everybody else smells like fire. I would dare say the king smells like fire right now. He's close enough. But these guys, they don't. They don't even smell like fire. Not only have they not been touched, they don't even smell like it. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. He's got more to say, but stop right there. Look at how Nebuchadnezzar treats this. Again, I like to think that Nebuchadnezzar was a pretty smart guy. He's a critical thinker. He's just seen the unthinkable happen. Now, prideful Nebuchadnezzar may have said, man, fire didn't do it. Kill him another way. They still violated my commands, cut their heads off, impale them, whatever. You've got plenty of things to do as the king. You can kill people any way you want. But he stops right there and recognizes that something special about these guys has happened, and he remembers what they said, that they spoke to the blasphemy first, and that they said, our God is able to do this. And he recognizes that maybe there's something to this God. Maybe there is something to be said for a God that is able to do this kind of thing. And Nebuchadnezzar is willing to recognize that. Yeah, and so he ensures as much as possible that his command is taken out and whatever his efforts have.
The action was like, wow, okay, I tried to beat that guy.
And it didn't work. Yeah, and it's pretty neat, too, because this is not the first time he's had a reaction like this either, right? Because his reaction to Daniel is also in recognition of Daniel's God's power. He probably recognizes that Daniel and Azariah and Mishael and Hananiah are part of the same group that he brought up. And so he would have recognized that they're part following the same God. And so not only is this God able to grant visions and understanding of those visions, but now this God has power over fire, over physical well-being, over life. What all can this God do? And that's something to think about, too, because not all gods were, you know, you think of the idolatry that goes on there, and they had to have, like, a number of gods. You had to have all sorts of gods to handle everything, because, you know, if you handle the weather, there's no way you're going to also be able to handle, the fertility, or what about, when there's earthquakes, you name it, right? You got to have a god for everything. But now, we've got a God who is apparently all knowledgeable and can deal with fire or, you know, tectonic events or weather or however you want to classify that in whatever God tree you have, now all of a sudden God is filling all sorts of boxes that you would not normally associate with the same God. So he's starting to learn some things about Jehovah just by the actions of his servants. Something special, yeah.
Something special. I mean, you know, we're not saying that Nebuchadnezzar recognized Christ, but certainly even in the Old Testament, there's plenty of allusions to Christ. I'm not saying this is the fact, but maybe God was sending a message there. You know, they didn't understand the Trinity until Christ came. But you know, all we know, it was, you know, to give that kind of idea as well.
And we really don't know about that, and whether or not it was an angel, whether it was Christ coming in some form. I tend to think it was probably just an angel of some kind, because Christ coming down to the earth was its own special event, right? There's all sorts of prophecies concerning when God would come down in the flesh, and this wasn't the fulfillment of that set of things, but all sorts of, you know, I think of, you know, maybe Greeks and Romans being the most prolific about these things, about gods coming and having relations with humans and coming forth with these half-mortal, half-deity offspring, and there was something special about them. And Nebuchadnezzar is able to recognize through this fire that there's something not quite human about this fourth guy. And so he's thinking maybe this is a demigod or something like that, that this is not quite human here. And so, yeah, he's recognizing that God is more powerful. And while he's come up and said before that, you know, God is God of all gods, that doesn't really seem to sink in yet, as we'll see further. But notice how he responds to this afterwards, and he says, "Blessed be him." And then in 29, he says, "Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the gods of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, insomuch as there is no other god who is able to deliver in this way." Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. So we get into the other favorite punishment here, where it's, okay, if we can't burn you, the other great punishment is we'll tear a timber from your house, and we'll impale you on it, and we'll destroy your house, and everybody will know that you angered the king. Right? It's sort of the make an example kind of a thing. But now, it's exactly opposite to his original command. Because now it's no longer bow to the gods of Babylon, but it's don't say anything bad about the god of these guys, because there's something special about him. And we'll see more about how Nebuchadnezzar is starting to change his mind next week when Dad takes back over. Thank you.